Hi guys, I would like to thank everyone who donates to the Patreon account. The donations keep the show going. My computer is ready to go kaput after 8 years, so the Patreon fund will help me get another computer, and that will, in turn, enable me to churn out more episodes. There will be more giveaways in the future, and just a reminder, you don't have to give a lot. A dollar a month would do. Any amount would be appreciated. Once again, the Patreon account is located at www.patreon.com/leader1. That's P-A-T-R-E-O-N and L-E-A-D-E-R-O-N-E. Thank you and enjoy the show. Welcome to Human Monsters. The intersection of Church Street and Wellesley Street in Toronto, Ontario, Canada, is the LGBT capital of the city. LGBT-related community events and political activities are usually concentrated in this neighborhood, which is also known as the Gay Village, or for brevity, the Village. It is also known as the Gay Ghetto and the Gayborhood. Many of the local businesses are owned and or operated by members of the LGBT community. Rainbow flags are a common sight all year round. The Gay Pride Parade and Dyke March originate from this neighborhood every year. It is one sector of the city where members of this demographic can feel accepted and safe. But from 2010 to 2017, gay men were targeted for violence in this community. They weren't your standard gay bashings by homophobic meatheads. This threat came from within, and it was far more sinister. It resulted in the deaths of 8 men. Violence and other forms of abuse infiltrated the lives of people who lived in this area before. But the presence of a serial killer was something new. Skandaraj Navaratnam was born in 1970 in Sri Lanka. A civil war broke out in North Sri Lanka in the 1980s, and there were few other options for a young man like Skandaraj. Either he could join the army or fight for the Tamil Tigers, deemed a terrorist organization by the Government of Canada. Rejecting either organization could mean certain death. He was an ecological activist who fought to protect the country's jungles and forests from deforestation. He was arrested for his advocacy. He was tortured while incarcerated. With his life in danger, Skanda was faced with no choice but to flee. He emigrated to Canada, which granted asylum to thousands of other Tamils. Skanda moved to an apartment close to the Church and Wellesley area, and he spent virtually all his spare time there. He made many friends in the neighborhood. He was remembered as charming by everybody from bartenders and regulars at the gay bar Zippers, the farmers market, neighbors, and other locals. Skanda was determined to create a new family for himself. Being disowned by one's family is not an uncommon experience in the gay community. So his closest associates were naturally receptive to being quote-unquote adopted, so to speak. Skanda also devoted this time to his first sexual and romantic experiences with men. He dated women on occasion, identifying as bisexual. He was hired by the University of Toronto to work as a research assistant. Life was good, and he was really coming into his own. August 31st, 2010. Skanda had a date with a man. It went well enough that his date sent a text message that went, "Thank you for a wonderful eve." That was the last day that anybody close to Skandaraj Navaratnam saw him alive. His date wondered why he hadn't heard from him. Was he being ghosted? He texted, "Did I pass or fail the audition?" He received no reply. Though Skanda would occasionally leave town for a few days on some kind of adventure, he wasn't so irresponsible that he would have left his dog alone in his apartment without having made arrangements for his care. His friend Jean-Guy Clotier submitted a missing persons report on September 13th. He sent a text to Skanda's cell phone, letting him know that his friends were worried and had contacted the police. No reply. Friends from across the community combined efforts and resources to find Skanda or at least ascertain details of its whereabouts. Posters were distributed from zippers. A Facebook group was created to help those who were concerned to coordinate searches of the local parks. No such luck. Abdul Basir Faizi, known to his friends as Basir, was born in Herat, Afghanistan, in the 1970s. He suffered through the Civil War and the ascent of the Taliban. He was married to a woman named Karima in Kabul in 1999. They fled to Canada in the early 2000s. He and his wife had two daughters. They settled in the Toronto suburb of Brampton. He was working at a printing and labeling company. He invested in rental properties and enjoyed a prosperous life with his family. His luck came to an end in 2010. His business partner betrayed him and absconded with all the money. To make matters worse, he was laid off. The hardships piled up, and he was left with no alternative but to declare bankruptcy. Basir was deeply unhappy. His entire life made him miserable. He hated his job. He wanted to move. He couldn't move back to Afghanistan because it would have put his family's safety at risk. He considered Ottawa the capital city of Canada. These problems could be remedied in fairly simple ways. It would have taken time and hard work, but he could have undone the damage done to his material security. There was another problem whose resolution was not quite so easy or accessible. He often took drives at night. He would tell his wife he was working late or meeting up with friends. The truth was, these drives took him to church in Wellesley. He became a regular at Zippers. He also frequented the Black Eagle, a dimly lit establishment that facilitated discretion. It was a leather bar. These men were usually older, hairier, and heavier set, or colloquially known in many circles as bears. He was also fond of frequenting the men-only bathhouses, like Steamworks and the Cellar. Basir befriended some of the locals. He told them he was bisexual and that he wanted to come out to his family. He said he would only do so when his children were grown up. His religion, Islam, also complicated matters with its anti-homosexuality stance. He sometimes sought support from Salam Canada, a community support group for gay Muslims. December 29th, 2010. Basir spent a few hours in the neighborhood. He went to the Black Eagle, then Steamworks, where he met a friend. At 11:30 p.m., he told his friend he was going home. They made plans to meet up 2 days later. His banking records indicated that his last transaction was made at a restaurant. That was the last documented record of his existence. His wife became worried when he didn't call and didn't come home. She called his cell phone, but it was turned off. Her sister reported him missing to the Peel Regional Police. Early 2011. Basir's car was ticketed and towed after being parked on a residential street beyond the legally permitted allocation of time. Majid Kahan was born and raised in Afghanistan. He grew up in a strict and conservative Muslim family. Majid had interests that existed outside of the realm of religion. He was artistically creative with a passion for music. He got married in 1983 and had two children. He and his family sought and received asylum in Canada. They settled in a suburb located in the Greater Toronto Area. He and his wife got a divorce in 2002. With the promise of a new life yet again, he was bound for church in Wellesley. He identified by his middle name, which was Hamid. He began frequenting the bathhouses. He came to terms with being gay and explored relations with other men. Bar patrons remember him fondly for his smile and his grandfather-like disposition. He would often serenade other patrons with Bollywood music. As he spent more and more time in the gay bars, Majid developed a substance abuse problem. First he drank to excess. Then he tried crack cocaine and struggled with an on-again, off-again addiction to the drug. He had a boyfriend named Kyle Andrews, who helped him acclimate to his new life as an openly gay man and a resident of Canada and church in Wellesley. In summer of 2012, they had a row and didn't speak to each other for a while. October 14th, Hamid and his son attended a family wedding. It was the last time his family saw him. His son filed a missing persons report on October 28th. Kyle was worried. He was concerned Hamid's disappearance was the result of a drug overdose. June 6, 2013. Police took to the streets of Church in Wellesley and distributed missing persons posters. This is a quote from a police press release. Investigators have concluded there are a number of similarities between the three men, and they have not been seen since they were reported missing. An investigation was launched with a task force assigned to the case. It was based in 51 Division, which is the headquarters of the Toronto Police Service. There wasn't much in the way of clues and leads. To quote one officer, "It's quite unusual. Look at the circumstances surrounding this case. We've not heard or seen from them for several years now. Is foul play suspected? That's unclear." Bruce MacArthur was born on October 8, 1951. His family were farmers. His parents took in several foster children who wound up doing farm chores. Bruce felt that he did more than his fair share of the labor. He resented his father because of this. He developed a theory that his father suspected he was gay and used hard labor as a way to toughen him up and quash any effeminate tendencies. He retaliated by taking his mother's side in theological debates. He attended high school in the town of Fenelon Falls, graduating in 1969. He was socially withdrawn and did not perform well academically. Nevertheless, he was remembered as a teacher's pet. It was there where he met his wife. They married when he was 23. He earned a diploma in business at a college in Barrie. In the late 1970s, Bruce and his wife moved to Toronto, where they dwelled in a high-rise apartment building. Bruce was hired by Eaton's, a Canadian department store and one of the country's oldest companies. Bruce and his wife didn't live in Toronto long. By 1970, they were living in Oshawa, which was located east of Toronto. He was hired to work as a salesman for the McGregor Sock Company. He went on later to work as an account manager for a men's clothing company. Bruce and his wife had two children. He became involved with a Presbyterian church, as his father had. Their family was dysfunctional. Both the children were socially awkward, like their father. They also struggled academically. His son told his girlfriend years later that his father was physically abusive. His son exhibited behavioral issues in the coming years. Financial problems also emerged, causing additional stress for the parents. Bruce did all he could to cope with the turmoil of his personal life, but religion wasn't working. Another strategy involved having an affair with another man in the early 1990s. He realized he was gay, though he had always known deep down that this was true. He stopped having sex with his wife for fear he might pass a sexually transmitted disease onto her. He met many men discreetly on the internet. Eventually, Bruce came out to his family, starting with his wife. They separated a year later, with Bruce moving to Toronto. There he began a relationship at the age of 46 with another middle-aged man. They moved in together, sharing an apartment in the Thorncliffe Park neighborhood. Bruce and his wife didn't have a clean break. There were financial issues to sort out, and their children were minors. Bruce met with a psychiatrist to deal with his anguish. He was chronically depressed, for which he was prescribed Prozac. Things did improve. He reconnected with his social circle in Oshawa, and he resolved his financial problems. His relationship with the man fell apart. His boyfriend did not want to give him the level of commitment he was looking for. October 31st, 2001. A man identified as David was a hustler. This evening he was off duty. He loved Halloween and was about to put some finishing touches on his costume. He was walking into the back door of his apartment building. He saw someone familiar jogging up behind him. He recognized the person, a man who had partaken of his services. He didn't remember the name. He held the door open for him. He assumed he must also live in this building. After getting reacquainted, he offered to have the man up to his suite to show him his Halloween costume. A minute after David unlocked and opened the door to his unit, the man clouted him with a pipe. David collapsed to the floor. The assailant was Bruce MacArthur. He stood above David and struck him several times. David managed to get hold of a candlestick and strike out in self-defense. After a standoff, David informed MacArthur he was going to call the police. MacArthur begged him to refrain from doing so. He yanked the phone cord out of the wall. David called 911 and MacArthur left. MacArthur turned himself in at a police detachment a few blocks away. He said to officers there, "I don't know why I did it." The injury to David's head required 5 stitches. MacArthur was charged with 2 counts of assault. He claimed the metal pipe was used for protection against street hustlers. He said he worried they might rob him. The court ordered a psychiatric evaluation. MacArthur mentioned his history with depression and his prescriptions of Prozac, but could not explain why he assaulted David. This is a report from the psychologist's evaluation of Bruce MacArthur. There is no trace of psychosis, no trace of hallucinations or delusions, no trace of mood disorder, and no trace of any personality disorder or antisocial behavior. As a matter of fact, Mr. MacArthur is well-oriented in space, time, and toward people. He is articulate and coherent. Mr. MacArthur's results suggest that he is characteristically indecisive, but he may possess underlying resentments. His profile portrays an exaggerated striving to be liked, as well as a rigid, intense compliance to social conventions. He seems to dread making public mistakes or taking risks, lest these provoke humiliation and disapproval from authorities. They decided his risk for more violent incidents in the future was, quote, very minimal, end quote. MacArthur didn't serve any time in jail for this crime. He was ordered to undergo anger management counseling and perform 100 hours of community service. Additionally, he was sentenced to a year of house arrest, allowed out only to go to work and attend pre-approved appointments. He was forbidden from visiting the church in Wellesley area for a year. He was not to contact the victim in any way, refrain from hiring sex workers, and to abstain from taking poppers. Poppers consist of a shot of amyl nitrate. It's a chemical whose official commercial purpose was to clean VHS tapes. When it is inhaled nasally, It can intensify orgasms and act as a muscle relaxant. MacArthur used poppers during sex regularly. He received 3 more years of probation, which included an order to stay away from the apartment complex in which David dwelled. The judge said conclusively, "It sounds to me like you're a pretty good person, and it sounds to me like you're not going to be back here anyway." Bruce MacArthur applied for a pardon after his probationary period ended, and it was granted, effectively wiping his record clean. After years of financial hardship and difficulties getting a job, MacArthur became a partner with a man named Roger Horan in a landscaping business called Artistic Design Limited. MacArthur did most of the labor, with his experience on the farm coming in handy. 2006. MacArthur's probation was over, and he submerged himself in the culture of church in Wellesley. He joined a club of gay fathers who frequently met for breakfast or coffee. He was a regular at the Second Cup coffee shop. He also became a regular presence at the bars and nightclubs. Skanda often worked for MacArthur on landscaping assignments, and they dated from time to time. A man named Joel Walker remembered Bruce MacArthur as being, quote, obsessive and controlling, end quote. He felt Bruce and Skanda's relationship was toxic. Bruce would ask Joel what the latest developments were after Skanda's disappearance. He would say to him, "Did the cops say they heard anything? Are they getting leads?" Joel was questioned by police, and as they took down names, one that kept coming up was Bruce MacArthur. Summer 2017. A new face appeared in one of the missing persons posters. His name was Andrew Kinsman. He was last seen alive on June 26th, 2 days before he was reported as missing. The Toronto Police Service classified him officially as missing on the 29th. Some speculated in the beginning that this disappearance was not related to the previously mentioned because Kinsman was white. Andrew's social connections in the village were deeply connected. He was also remembered as someone who wasn't inclined to simply disappear on a whim. He lived in the district of Cabbage Town, which is just a few blocks away from church in Wellesley. He didn't drink much, but enjoyed bar hopping nonetheless. He was married to a man named Ted. He was remembered as quick-witted, with a dark sense of humor, though he had a sweet side to him. He was very driven and didn't suffer fools gladly. He was the superintendent of the building he lived in. Among his hobbies were canning and baking. He worked part-time for the Toronto People with AIDS Foundation. He didn't see it as just a means to supplement his income. For him, it was a calling. He took responsibility for the Essentials Market, which was a food bank made available to recipients of the agency's alms. He hoped he could make this gig into a full-time job and a career. It goes without saying that Andrew was as keen to give back to his community everything he had been given, and more. As far as any causes of his death unrelated to violence and murder went, suicide was ruled out. He was happy and living a meaningful life. He didn't have a drug habit that would have resulted in an overdose. He was last seen by a neighbor friend before heading out for a driving test. His friends postered the neighborhood and made as many inquiries as they could to determine Andrew's whereabouts. Police searched his apartment for clues, as well as to discover any possible signs of foul play. Andrew was distrustful of banks and kept cash hoards in his home. If he had simply run off to begin a new life, he surely would have taken the money with him. The investigators left no stone uncovered within legal limits, but so far there were no clues. Investigating this chain of disappearances proved difficult. Without even a body to be examined by a coroner to determine the official cause of death, there was nothing to go on. The police were accused of doing nothing, but police work is not easy, especially when you can't even build the baseline foundation of a case. On July 28, 2017, the Toronto Police Service launched Project PRISM. They issued a press release regarding the initiative. The purpose was to investigate the disappearance of Andrew Kinsman, though the name of a new victim emerged, Salim Essen. Essen was very similar to the first three men, whose disappearances were being investigated by an initiative called Project Houston. He was of Turkish extraction. He was a fixture of the church in Wellesley area. He disappeared on April 15th. He was remembered as having a silver rolling suitcase and living a somewhat nomadic existence with no fixed address. He was a drug addict, though he was working on overcoming this problem. He was also in the process of getting an apartment. Fear and paranoia swept throughout Church in Wellesley. Advisories to be vigilant about one's personal safety were distributed throughout social media. The bars with televisions were perpetually turned to the news. All denizens of this community were anxious for the perpetrators of these crimes to be identified and brought to justice. Links among all five missing men were not confirmed by the police, as noted in a press release. There has been some suggestion within the Church Wellesley community that the disappearances of Andrew Kinsman and Salim Essen are linked, as well as with three other men reported missing from the same area from 2010 to 2012. Detailed investigation and evidence obtained thus far in the course of both investigations has not confirmed a link, although, as part of the police investigation, this is being considered. Residents of Church in Wellesley were not satisfied with this assessment of the situation and were convinced that not only were all five disappearances linked, but that a serial predator had swooped down on their stomping ground and was poised to dig its talons into anybody who was alone, vulnerable, and invisible to the vigilant eyes of potential witnesses. Police had a look at Andrew Kinsman's calendar. Most of what Andrew wrote was cryptic, but the entry for June 26, 2017 contained something unmistakable. 3 p.m., Bruce. One promising lead emerged. Detective Charles Coffey ran a search on all the 2004 Dodge Caravan 20th Anniversary Edition minivans that were registered in Ontario. They ran a check on all owners whose given names were Bruce. Such a vehicle was observed in security camera footage at Andrew Kinsman's building the day he was believed to have disappeared. The Ministry of Transportation disclosed that only one Bruce owned that particular model of van. That Bruce was also documented by Versedex, a records management software utilized by Toronto Police. It is a database of, quote, all general occurrences, known offenders, street checks, radio calls for the Toronto Police Service, and any other data by the service, end quote. The final results. Bruce MacArthur, born October 8, 1951, owned a 2004 red Dodge Caravan. Detective Josh McKenzie ran a check on a cell phone number that was attached to a deleted contact in Scanda's email. The associated caller was Bruce MacArthur, born 1951. Basir and Scanda had profiles on a gay dating site called SilverDaddies.com. Bruce MacArthur also had a profile on that site. Investigators put Bruce MacArthur down as, quote, a possible person of interest in Kinsman's disappearance, end quote. Project PRISM ran MacArthur's name in the internal police database. Though MacArthur received a pardon and an expunction of his criminal record, there was still a record of his arrest for assault in the police database. They discovered something else. He was arrested in 2016. MacArthur met up in the parking lot of a Tim Hortons coffee shop with an unidentified man he had sex with on occasion. MacArthur insisted that they have sex in his van. The back of his van has been referred to by one of MacArthur's partners as the, quote, little traveling playroom, end quote. Characterizing it as such, he did not intend it to be a term of endearment. The seats were removed, a tarp was laid out on the floor with a fur coat spread on top. Though the man gave his consent to engage in rough sex, he wasn't prepared for how rough Bruce MacArthur liked it. Rough turned to violent as Bruce wrapped his hands around the man's neck. He squeezed long enough to pry any last vestiges of the man's willingness to submit out from him. The man was unable to escape. He was pinned underneath Bruce MacArthur's considerable girth. The man began to fight back. He rolled to his right and squirmed out of MacArthur's grip. He pushed him back. He was free from his grasp now. He lunged forward and grabbed MacArthur by the throat. He leapt out of the van a minute later. Free of the van, the man began screaming at MacArthur. He pulled out his cell phone and threatened to call 911. Bruce just sat there at first, but a moment later he climbed into the front seat and drove away. The man did call 911 and told the operator he considered chasing MacArthur, but they talked him out of it. When the police arrived, they took a statement from the man. He told them about the incident and some of the background of his relationship with MacArthur, how they hooked up off and on for years. After running a search on MacArthur's phone number, they got his address, whereupon they paid a visit to his apartment complex. Too late. Bruce MacArthur went to 41 Division to make a statement, as he said to the officer at the front desk, "I just want to tell my side of the story." Bruce MacArthur was placed under arrest for suspicion of domestic assault. He waived his right to be represented by an attorney. While giving a statement to police, he insisted that he believed the man wanted to be choked and it was all misunderstanding. Investigators recalled that he came across as, quote, genuine and credible, end quote. Though there was not enough evidence to make the charge stick, the arrest was nonetheless documented by police. Investigation into Bruce MacArthur's life continued, which included surveillance. They even grabbed a disposable coffee cup he drank out of and derived a DNA sample. Every friend and business associate and client they could get a hold of was contacted and questioned. Bruce MacArthur sold his van to a scrapyard. Police impounded it and submitted it to forensic investigators. They found small traces of blood and semen. DNA analysis found that the blood matched Andrew Kinsman's genetic profile. The other patches of blood were neither a match for Kinsman nor MacArthur. The police now had enough evidence to charge MacArthur with the murder of Andrew Kinsman. They applied to a judge for a search warrant. They would now be able to search MacArthur's apartment. Having been granted judicial authorization, they visited his apartment when he was not at home on December 5th. They couldn't stay long. The GPS tracker on MacArthur's car notified the officers that he was returning home. They returned 2 days later. They paired off with members of the Technological Crime Unit focusing on MacArthur's computer. They copied the entire contents of his hard drive. Other detectives searched his bedroom. In the drawer of his bedside table, they found a thick metal bar. They took a photo of it and swabbed it for DNA. When the GPS notified that MacArthur was en route to his building, they put everything back and left. Back at the station, investigators who had managed to copy the contents of MacArthur's computer found photos of the victims profiled in Project Houston. There were also images of their missing persons posters. Some were downloaded from social media pages, while others were taken by MacArthur. He also downloaded copies of news stories concerning the disappearances. This was valuable data, but the police needed evidence of foul play before they could put Bruce MacArthur under arrest. Their next move was to wiretap his phone. January 17th, 2018. Detective Constable Joel Manhurst took another deep dive into the contents of Bruce MacArthur's hard drive. This time he was looking for fragments of archived files, including items that were deleted but detectable by a computer expert who knows how to find them. There was a folder of photos MacArthur deleted. Some of them were taken in his bedroom. Some were taken in his van. There was a shot of Salim Hassan with the metal bar being pressed against his neck. Andrew Kinsman was seen in another photo lying in the back of the van. There were obvious signs that he was dead at the time the picture was taken. There were shots of men whose identities were unknown to police at that time. Now the Toronto Police Service detectives had their evidence. They had a serial killer on their hands. Protocols were carried out to arrest Bruce MacArthur. January 18th, Bruce MacArthur brought home a man named John he met on Growler, a dating app for gay men that fit Bruce MacArthur's physical profile, older, heavy-set, and scruffy in appearance. As soon as they walked in the door, MacArthur ordered John to follow him to the bedroom and remove his clothing without delay. MacArthur said to him, "We have to hurry. My roommate or son could be home any minute." With John now in the nude, Bruce walked back in the room, this time brandishing handcuffs. He said to John, "We're going to try something different." Bruce handcuffed John to the bed and walked away, leaving him alone for a minute. When he returned, he was carrying a black duffel bag. He pulled out a black leather hood. He put it over John's head. Unlike many such leather hoods, this one had no zipper at the mouth or holes of any other kind. John struggled to breathe. He flew into a panic. He asked Bruce to remove the hood. Bruce ignored his pleas. John struggled against the confines of the hood until he writhed his head out of it. Bruce pinned him down and taped his mouth shut. There was a knock at the door. Bruce walked to the entryway and opened the door. Detectives Patrick Platt and Dave Dickinson informed Bruce MacArthur that he was under arrest. Now MacArthur was the one placed in handcuffs against his will. When the detectives saw MacArthur enter his building with a man of color, it occurred to them that the man in question was in serious danger, and they had to act immediately. John was liberated by one of the officers, and not a minute too soon. The police made the following announcement at a press conference at 1:15 p.m. that day. This morning at approximately 10:25 a.m., police arrested 66-year-old Bruce MacArthur of the City of Toronto. He is self-employed as a landscaper using the company name Artistic Design, and he lives in the Thorncliffe Park area. He has been charged with 2 counts of first-degree murder in relation to Mr. Kinsman, and we believe he is responsible for the deaths of other men who have yet to be identified. In other words, we believe there are other victims. As of right now, interviews are taking place and police have secured 5 properties. 4 in Toronto and 1 in Madoc, connected to Bruce MacArthur, in an effort to further investigate these occurrences. Investigators are asking for the continued assistance of the public in this investigation. Karen Fraser was one of Bruce MacArthur's landscaping clients. She received a knock at the door. 2 police officers were there. One of them said to her, "You've got 5 minutes to get out." They explained that her gardener, Bruce MacArthur, was arrested. They didn't tell her what he was arrested for, but assured her it was a very serious matter. She asked them to show her a search warrant. They promised one was coming. Karen and her husband packed suitcases since they did not know how long their house would be occupied by the police. They were ordered by the police to report to 51 Division for an interview. They did notify them that they knew they were not guilty of the crimes for which Bruce MacArthur was arrested. The Toronto Police Service issued another press release. Toronto police charged 66-year-old Bruce MacArthur with first-degree murder in connection to the disappearances of Celine Essen and Andrew Kinsman. The police searched every home MacArthur worked at and visited over the previous several years. The K-9 unit was brought into Karen Fraser's backyard. As Karen noted, they did know it was the Planters. They brought the dogs in and, as they put it, in police jargon, the dogs attended the Planters. They zeroed right in on them. The police called them a day later. As Karen recalled, they told us what they had found in the Planters. At Bruce MacArthur's first court appearance, he was notified that he was charged with 2 counts of first-degree murder. January 29th, the Toronto Police Service gave another press conference. As you know, on January 18th, Bruce MacArthur was arrested and charged with 2 counts of first-degree murder in relation to the deaths of Celine Essen and Andrew Kinsman. Since then, we have continued our investigation, including searches of numerous properties associated with Mr. MacArthur, a review of material evidence, and interviews with dozens of people, many of whom have come forward to us. I do want to offer some clarity on the intersection between Projects Houston, PRISM, and the homicide cases. We know the community has been and continues to be deeply concerned about these past investigations, specifically the seriousness with which we looked at these cases. On Wednesday, January 17th, investigators uncovered evidence which provided them with grounds to believe that Mr. MacArthur was not only responsible for the death of Andrew Kinsman, but was also responsible for the death of Mr. Essen. Further evidence was uncovered, which led investigators to believe that Mr. MacArthur was responsible for the deaths of other unidentified victims. On Thursday, January 18th, Mr. MacArthur was arrested by members of Project PRISM. He was charged with 2 counts of first-degree murder in relation to Mr. Kinsman and Mr. Essen. Today, Mr. MacArthur was brought back before the courts. Mr. MacArthur has now been charged with 3 additional counts of first-degree murder. These new charges are in relation to the murders of Majid Kahan, Sarush Mahmoudi, and Dean Lisowick. Majid Kahan was one of the males whose disappearances was investigated by Project Houston. Sarush Mahmoudi was 50 years old when he was reported missing in Scarborough by his family in 2015. Dean Lisowick was never reported as missing, but we believe that he was murdered between May of 2016 and July of 2017. Sarush Mahmoudi was born in Iran. He worked as a painter. He was married to a Sri Lanka-born woman named Farina and was her son's stepfather. He owned 6 properties, which he bought and sold as he downgraded his own living arrangements. They were mostly located in the town of Barrie, which is north of Toronto. He and his wife filed for bankruptcy in spring 2014. Though undeserving of being murdered as well as the other victims, Sarush did have some troublesome issues. He was an alcoholic who drove drunk and was charged with DUIs. He also assaulted a woman, he once stated. He left his home in Scarborough one day in mid-August 2015, never to return. Dean Lisowick resided in Toronto in the loosest sense of the word. When he wasn't living on the streets, he stayed at shelters, usually in the church in Wellesley area. It wasn't unusual for him to go missing. He was a transient, so it came with the territory. He grew up indigent. His family were from Winnipeg but moved to Toronto in hopes of seizing whatever opportunities for economic advancement might come their way. There was no improvement in their fortunes. Things went from bad to worse. His parents separated. At the age of 8, Dean was taken into custody by the Catholic Children's Aid Society and placed with a farming couple in a small town called Eudora, Ontario. His father visited on the weekends. He established a close bond with his adoptive brothers. Unfortunately, there was a dark underbelly to his experience in Eudora. He was sexually abused. He was removed from the property when social workers were notified. Dean was eventually placed in another foster home until he left that home and returned to Toronto to reunite with his family. Relations within his family's homestead were still tumultuous, and he sought refuge on the streets of Church and Wellesley. He fell in with drug users and dealers. As a result, he frequently ran afoul of the law. He had a daughter who was born in 1994, but he was in no shape to raise a child, so he immersed himself in the village. He identified as bisexual and frequently worked as a hustler. Toronto's job market is intensely competitive, with thousands of applicants seizing on every opportunity like ants on a melted popsicle. When sex work dried up for Dean, he experienced difficulty in finding a legitimate job because of his criminal record. He resorted to begging on Church Street. He would receive meals at soup kitchens. He slept in shelters. He would take odd jobs, and on occasion he would get an apartment, but he would leave after a few months. February 8th, 2018. The police held a press conference to give an update on their findings regarding the victims of Bruce MacArthur. Police: I can now confirm we have recovered the remains of at least six individuals over the last week and a half, and we have identified some of the body parts as belonging to one of the victims who we charged Mr. MacArthur with the murder of, and that's Andrew Kinsman. That's where we stand right now. The identification of the other remains is still ongoing. Reporter: Do you anticipate more charges being laid? Police: I do anticipate more charges being laid. I don't have a timetable for that. I don't have a number for that. But I would expect more charges will eventually be laid. Reporter: What about the planters? Police: We have approximately 15 planters in total. So exactly where we are in the examination of those planters, I'm not going to say. Reporter: What's under the tent? Police: All that is under that tent is a grassy area that we've scanned with the Ontario Provincial Police ground-penetrating radar. We've identified some spots in there that we're interested in, and we've been heating that ground now for over a week, and I'm led to believe that it's probably still not completely thawed. So, we hope to dig down until we can't dig anymore, which may be a matter of inches. And then we may have to leave it for another day or two, let it thaw some more, and then continue again. So it's going to be a long process. February 23rd. Police slapped Bruce MacArthur with a sixth charge of murder, this one for Skanda Navaratnam. The police held another press conference. As you know, on January 18th, Bruce MacArthur was arrested. He had been charged with five counts of first-degree murder in relation to the deaths of Salim Essen, Andrew Kinsman, Sarush Mahmoudi, Dean Lisowick, and Majin Kahan. Since then, we have continued our investigation, including searches of numerous properties associated to Mr. MacArthur, the review of material evidence, and interviews with dozens of people, many of whom have come forward to us. One of the focuses of the investigation has been on human remains found in the planters from 53 Mallory Crescent. The remains of at least six individuals have been recovered from these planters. I've already released the fact that the remains of Andrew Kinsman were located within the planters. There are several ways of identifying remains in a case such as this, including fingerprints, dental records, and DNA analysis. Some of these processes are obviously more time-consuming than others. We have now identified the remains of three individuals from these planters. Number one being Andrew Kinsman, number two being Sarush Mahmoudi, and number three being Skandaraj Navaratnam. In an interview with the Globe and Mail newspaper, Toronto Police Service Chief Mark Saunders gave an interview. When asked why the police were so reluctant to declare that a serial killer was responsible for all the disappearances, he had this to say: Our role is to follow the evidence. And if you don't have any evidence, then you dig harder to see, to make sure. You do the checks, double checks. With all of these investigations, you don't just sit back on your hands and go, "Nothing's coming, and see you later." We go out. We aggressively try to pursue and look for that. We knew that people were missing, and we knew that we didn't have the right answers. But nobody was coming to us with anything. Nobody. Crime investigation is a science. Just like how a doctor doesn't rely on anecdotal accounts given by patients to diagnose an illness, police only lay charges when there is sufficient evidence to issue an arrest warrant. Credibility is crucially important for a detective investigating a murder. There are dozens of murders every year in Toronto, and they are never linked by a single serial offender. The way to investigate a murder is to read a story from the last page backwards. The problem is, the rest of the pages are blank. In the Bruce MacArthur murder case, there was no last page to begin with. When you have a body, you can at least have it analyzed by a pathologist to determine the cause of death. That information is highly valuable, and with a combination of forensic science and advanced speculative criminal behavior profiling, you can pick up a trail. This case started with nothing but missing persons reports. Because none of the missing people were minors, the reports were not acted upon with as much urgency. After all, adults are free to disappear as much as they like. March 5th. Detective Sergeant Hank Nsinga gave a press conference to update the public on the progress of the investigation of the Bruce MacArthur murders. "The release of evidence by the Toronto Police Service has to strike a balance between the public interest and the fair court process due to Mr. MacArthur. We solve many crimes through the release of evidence to the media. Today we are going to release a photograph of an individual who we believe is an unidentified victim of Mr. MacArthur. We have utilized numerous investigative techniques to identify this individual and so far have been unsuccessful. We have also shown the picture to numerous contacts within the community and have been unsuccessful. I do not want to release this picture, and I'm doing so as a last resort." A photo was displayed on a screen to Nsinga's right. He appealed to whomever could have identified the man to come forward with information. April 16th, Detective Nsinga held a press conference to announce the identity of the unnamed man in the photo. "I can now report that the remains have been identified as Karushna Kumar Kanagaratnam. Mr. Kanagaratnam arrived in Canada in 2010 from Sri Lanka and lived in the Scarborough area of Toronto. He was not on file as missing, and we have no prior evidence which would link him to the Gabe village. We believe that Mr. Kanagaratnam was murdered between the time period of September 3rd to December 14th, 2015. July 5th, Hank Nsinga gave a press conference regarding the excavations that were underway at the sites where Bruce MacArthur plied his trade. Yesterday afternoon, human remains were located at one of the first digging sites. The police were searching for human remains, piecemeal or intact. Bones, skin, teeth, they were ready for anything. Their hypothesis was that, over the course of 7 years, MacArthur packed the dismembered corpses of his victims into large planters, whereupon he covered them with soil and transplanted seasonal plants into the topsoil. With the advent of autumn, he would dump the flowers, the soil, and the body parts onto a compost pile, which would be situated in a ravine nearby. Their speculation proved correct. July 26, 2018. This was a final update from police headquarters given as part of a press conference. "I can now report that we have recovered and identified the remains of Majid Kahan from the ravine. Bruce MacArthur is already charged with the murder of Majid Kahan, who we alleged was killed in 2012, although the examination and identification of remains continues. We do not have any evidence to suggest that Mr. MacArthur is responsible for any more than the 8 murders for which he currently stands charged. At this time, we have no evidence to suggest that there are any further remains to be located at any further locations. The review of numerous cold cases and outstanding missing persons cases continues. January 29, 2019. Bruce MacArthur appeared in court. He and the judge, Justice John McMahon, engaged in the following dialogue. You understand you have a right to a fair trial? Yes. Is anyone pressuring you to plead guilty? No. Justice McMahon read all the names of the victims. He asked Bruce MacArthur if he planned and carried out the murders of which he was accused in a premeditated and deliberate fashion. MacArthur affirmed this. Justice McMahon then asked him how he would plead to every count of first-degree murder. This exchange followed. Majid Kahan, guilty. Sarush Mahmoodi, guilty. Dean Lisowick, guilty. Salim Ehsan, guilty. Andrew Kinsman, guilty. Skandaraj Navaratnam, guilty. Karushna Kumar Kanagaratnam, guilty. Abdul Basir Faizi, guilty. The Crown Prosecutor warned anybody who wanted graphic details that it might not be worth their while. It could impact your appetite and ability to sleep. He urged everyone to consider whether they wanted to remain in the courtroom, especially if they were close to the victims. Strangulations. The discoloration around the neck of Karushna Kumar Kanagaratnam. MacArthur shaved Salim Ehsan's face after he died. He took photos of each man post-mortem. Some were naked. Some had a cigar stuck between their lips. He would regularly mix and reposition body parts after they had decomposed and skeletonized in the soil. He retained a bag of hair. The details were based solely on evidence gathering, since MacArthur did not give a confession. Days later, Justice McMahon announced MacArthur's sentence. Life in prison with no possibility for 25 years. He is serving a sentence at Millhaven Institution, where Paul Bernardo currently dwells. An inmate assaulted MacArthur on April 29, 2019. The impact was severe enough that MacArthur required hospitalization. It's not the karma they were hoping for, but it was likely pleasing to all the families and spouses of the men he killed. Thank you for listening to Human Monsters. Bye for now.